Raw Health Radio.
All right, everyone, welcome back to episode number 35 of the show. Today we're joined by a naturopath and a nutritionist to talk to us about empowering our lives through food. Now, as you're probably all aware, you might have seen things on Facebook and all over the internet saying, this is the right diet, this is the right way you should eat, this is how it's supposed to be done. But as you know, I'm not a huge fan of teaching people nutrition that way. It's not really about what someone thinks is right for you, it's about what's actually right for you. No one can ever really tell you that. So my guest today was the co-host of Good Chef, Bad Chef, which you might have seen if you're in Australia watching Channel 10. She's the author of Supernatural Foods, Whole Food Kitchen, and a book which sits on the shelf in my favourite cafe in all of Sydney called Elixir, How to Use Food as Medicine. And I've really got to buy that book because I open it up every single time and go, wow, this is a good book. But I haven't actually gone through and bought it yet, so I will do that. Now, my guest name is Janella. She's on the line right now. How are you going today, Janella?
I'm good, David. Would that be a little cafe in Mossman that you go to? Or like Surrey Hills?
It's little sister in Avalon.
Oh, and they have the book there.
Yes. Yeah. I go to that cafe in Mossman. I know the one you're talking about, and I keep ordering the pit water, which they serve at the one in Avalon.
They're the same owners, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And the waitresses keep looking at me like, what's the pit water? Oh, yeah, that's right. You call it the Balmoral.
Oh.
That's a Sydney joke, so no one out there will get that one.
I consulted on those cafes with their menus a couple of years ago, so that's why they're in there.
Well, that is my favourite cafe in Sydney.
Good.
And I go to...
There's not more of them popping up around Australia.
I agree. Now, why don't we get started with a little bit of a story around how you got involved in the naturopath and nutrition world?
I think that I was born to do this. I never, ever questioned what I was going to do. I always wanted to help, and I was never a really healthy child, even though I should have been. I came from a really healthy family. Both my parents are health conscious. They're still really well. So we ate beautiful food. My mother's of Lebanese heritage. So we ate and cooked well. I exercised, you know, I played a lot of sport, obviously, and I just was a happy, loved child. So the fact that I had bloating and lots of gut issues from day dot was a mystery. So Mum always thought it was because I was an anxious, worried, overcaring, over-empathic child, which I think has a lot to do with it. And so she took me off to a psychologist when I was about 11 or 12 because there was nothing wrong physically that the medicos could see. So it just really went from there. I went on a journey of self-discovery to understand myself and understand why I could eat some things sometimes and not other things other times, especially when I was stressed. And then I had I was diagnosed with endometriosis quite young, which is a reproductive disorder that's quite common now. But in those days, so 30 years ago, it was not. And that was just adding to what I was gaining weight. I had diarrhea. I was bloated. I was tired, but I had a beautiful diet. So that's really how I started cooking a lot. And then I got to become a chef. I started my apprenticeship and I had to chop up meat on the first day and went, no, because I hadn't eaten meat since I was a young girl. So I stopped the apprenticeship and got my papers by time on the job, and then I went into naturopathy and nutrition and then Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine and kinesiology. So it's been an evolving organic process.
Love it. Now, when it comes to the nutritional environment and the industry the way it is at the moment, it seems like everyone's wrong about everything. There are people out there saying, don't eat gluten because it's bad for you. There are people out there saying, don't stop eating gluten. It's good for your bowels. And everyone's contradicting everyone else. And there's a huge potential in that for anxiety and overanalyzing to happen, which is not a good thing. How do you teach people to be empowered by food rather than scared by all these different conflicting opinions?
Well, I think, first of all, choose who you listen to. When I started on telly, which was year 2000, so what, 15 years ago, and the first gig I did was the Today Show on Channel 9, there was no one on TV talking about nutrition or food as medicine, and I was considered a freak, and I was called a freak quite often, that there was a relationship between food and your health. I mean, that was only 15 years ago. So now I'm mainstream. It's really quite interesting. So there's every Tom, Dick and Harry and celebrity out there is spruiking something, and everyone's got their idea of what is going to save the world and give you a happy relationship and make you rich and, you know, have a happy life. But I don't know why we're all giving our power away, which is why I wanted to call this talk Empower Your Life Through Food, because food is the new black, isn't it? Chefs, celebrity chefs are the new supermodels. Everybody has got, a lot of people have got something to say, and I don't like the way that their answer is definitive and it's right instead of, well, this might work for you. So I think the first thing is decide who you're going to listen to and cut that down. Don't go here and people are, you know, getting drip fed from a lot of different places and getting a lot of info off Dr. Google and on the net, and it's really, really confusing. So I think choose who you listen to, make sure that they've got experience and education in health and nutrition and in food, not just in being a celebrity. I think that's empowering in itself.
Now, what about tertiary educated nutrition students? Because I've been there and done that, and that's not necessarily a license to just call yourself an expert and be seen as, you know, someone who knows exactly what's going on. Now, you went through university as well. What are your thoughts on the university approach to nutrition in Australia at the moment?
To answer your first bit though, don't you think it's better to listen to somebody who's had 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years of education than someone who hasn't or has got a six-month education through that New York Nutrition Institute, which is what a lot of people have got these days. Lots of people go, oh, I've done that course, and it's expensive and it's 6 months. I would rather listen to someone who's got a master's in nutrition or in biochemistry who knows the body rather than a really short course, because there's lots of them now because people are, you know, these colleges are, you know, making money out of it. I don't think doing a degree or a diploma at all makes you an expert. I think having that and then experience in clinic, and not just in a health food shop, although that gives you a lot of experience in the beginning and gives you confidence to get into practice. But I mean 10 or 20 years in a clinical situation one-on-one with patients. Then, you know, then you start to know what's going on. And now even we're still learning so much more that we don't know. The more we're learning, the more we don't know. It's quite overwhelming, actually. It's really overwhelming. But myself, when I have a health issue and I go to someone, because as I think it was Socrates or Plato that said, if you have yourself as a physician, you have a fool as a doctor. It's when I go to people, I find it really difficult to find a good holistic integrative practitioner. It's not that easy. You have to be really careful who you go to. But sure, I mean, university, anyone can study, really, if you've got a bit of discipline. You need to have a certain... Nutrition is just about nutrition. I mean, that's why I went on after I studied naturopathy and nutrition to do Chinese medicine, because I didn't feel like I even scratched the surface after 4 years. I mean, I knew herbs, it was wonderful learning about herbs, but I didn't learn nutrition. I didn't really want to know about supplements, and we spent a lot of time learning about supplements. I wanted to know about food as medicine, and there wasn't a subject for that. So Chinese medicine taught me a lot of that. And then Ayurvedic medicine is da bomb, and so is kinesiology, brings it all together. I found it did for me anyway.
I did study a bit of Ayurveda when I was in university, and I was fascinated by it. We just kind of scratched the surface on it as well, and I thought it was the most...
What were you studying at university?
That was part of a degree called Human Movement, and I've covered it in my current degree, which is musculoskeletal therapy.
That's great they're giving. Is it an elective?
No, it was a core subject.
Wow, that's fantastic. Two times are changing. My word. Right.
Now, when it comes to health experts on the internet, pretty much everyone's a health expert, and people are trying to tell everyone else what to eat and why they shouldn't eat certain things. Why do you think that's a faulty model?
It's the same reason I think that it's faulty that people tell you who to go out with and tell children what to do and control their lives. I think being told what to do on any subject isn't – who wants to be told what to do? I think it's when you wake up then to do something about it that you feel empowered instead of going, oh, I hate being told what to do. And no one likes to know. We want to be the master of our ship, the captain of our soul. We need to be. And in order to do that, we feel less stress and less distress in our life. So I don't know, to telling people what is right for them, how can we get anywhere? Although, having said that, patients do want to be diagnosed with something so then they know what's wrong with them, which I think isn't a great way that we're treating at the moment. And people want to know exactly what to do when they leave there, because they're spending a bit of money to come and see you. But this is the re-education, and that's what I do with my patients, that we're going to do this together. And we're gonna try some stuff and see what works, because everybody is really, really different. You can't say to someone, eat no grains, and then to someone else, eat grains. You can't say to someone, you should be a vegan, veggie, dairy-free, nut-free, soy-free, raw person, and then the next person the same thing. It's we're just really different. Plus, you know, then when I was at college, we were learning about the blood type diet. That was kind of big at the time. And Peter Dahmer, who wrote that, his son was lecturing us. And, you know, I'm a B positive, for example. So I'm meant to be eating meat and dairy. If I eat meat and dairy, it's not pretty. It's not pretty, because my liver and gallbladder aren't pretty, and they weren't born very strong. So I'm not supposed to eat lentils, avocado, alfalfa, corn. I mean, there's everything, tofu, tempeh. I eat now that suits me. According to the blood type diet and my ancestors, I'm not supposed to eat. But that's not taking into account Janella. That's taking into account that my blood type's B positive. And plus, there's more than five different blood types. We just move them all into five. So it's a little bit, it's not looking at the person. I think we absolutely need to start. I mean, we've been talking about this for ages, alternative complementary practitioners. You look at the person and then go from there, not the other way around. Where do they live? Who do they live with? Do they hate their job? Do they hate their mother? Have they had trauma in their childhood? Have they got post-traumatic stress? Is the adrenaline so – have they got adrenal fatigue? You need to look at the person and what's going on in their life and what has gone on in their life, because it's stored in their cells.
We'll get to that point in a second, but you mentioned – diagnosis earlier. Now, that's what a doctor will do. They'll bring you into their office and they'll say, here's what's going on. Here's what we see as being the solution for you. Now,
a nice pill.
Well, I wasn't going to say that, but yeah, that's generally what they'll give you.
Yeah.
Hippocrates said it best when he said, don't treat the disease that has the person, treat the person that has the disease. Now, a complementary approach to medicine would say, all right, you've come in because your back hurts, or you've got brain fog, or you've got pain, which someone might call endometriosis or whatever, but instead of saying, here's the problem and here's what you should do to fix it, there'd be a different approach. What would a complementary approach look like?
Exactly what I just said. How do you feel about your femininity, for example, if you've got endometriosis? So this is a second chakra issue. It's a female reproductive issue. So we're looking at somebody's, I mean, not in every case, but often you can find something that women want to talk about when you're coming to their sexuality or their femininity. So, you know, this is body-mind medicine. So I talk to them about how they feel about certain things. If it's it depends what tool I'm going to use. If I go into chakras and throat chakra, if they've got ongoing tonsillitis and they've got ongoing sore throat, and even if they get their tonsils out, they've still got that. Once it gets into your body, you've had many warnings through all of your bodies around your physical body, your ethereal body, everything. There's warnings in your subconscious that something's not wrong. Something's wrong. Our bodies don't have voices, as we hear often. The symptoms are the voice. So we need to look at the symptoms when the body's going, hey, dude, over there. I don't like it when you let that person treat you like shit. You need to stop that. And if you keep doing that, then you're going to get it in that part of the body. So it really, really, that is what empowers people and clients, because then they can take charge of it in their own life. I find a lot of people that don't want to look at this stuff because it's hard and there's no point saying it's not, go to Western practitioners and get a pill for it, because that'll take away the symptom but not away the cause. So looking at, you know, the area where the problem is and where people put it is really interesting. You know, it's some people put it straight on their face and they can't deny that, because most of us are vain and we don't want to have eczema or acne. Other people, you know, it's really interesting where it goes. It's just really interesting. And then you start to talk to them about their lives and what's happened to them, and it's a jigsaw puzzle, and getting little pieces with each sentence is exhilarating, I find. And for both of us, because most people have never done this sort of work.
So that takes a lot of stress off people as well, because instead of a symptom being a bad thing, it's something that we can learn from. So for you...
A blessing.
Yeah. Eating dairy might have given you a headache, or it might have given you pain or brain fog or something like that, but it was a step closer to you getting towards your health goal, which is one step of which is realizing you can't eat dairy. And it doesn't matter if you ate dairy and it made you feel bad, or if you stopped eating dairy and it made you feel better. the lesson was the same and you're still equally closer towards your goal.
Yeah, and also it's empowering, again, to know that you can stop eating something. And if that food doesn't own you. I actually had a client last night, well, she was 12, it was the daughter of a client, and she has got a rash on her face, and it looks like something that she's, it looks like an intolerance to a food. And she, I mean, she's 12, you know, she didn't want to stop eating her ham, cheese, tomato, white bread rolls every day. So I just said to her, you're old enough now to make these decisions about how you want to run your life. If you want to have that on your face as you're going into puberty, go for it, love. Keep eating your rolls. You have the choice to make. Stop even eating one of those things every day, and even stop eating it every day, and you see how that affects your face, and then you decide if you're going to eat that or not. You don't need me to sit here and go, stop eating white bread and cheese, because she's just going to be pissed off that someone's telling her what to do. I would have been if I, when I was 12, I had to come to it myself, and I did, and it's put me on my path, and it's very empowering to know that you can look at your body and go, okay, I mean, I could never have dairy, but now I can have goat's dairy and I can have sheep's dairy because I've strengthened my immunity in my stomach, which is what it's about, really. It's not so much about the food, although it's pretty crap, a lot of our food now. But, yeah, it is. It's empowering for people to know that you can still have things, even the worst things sometimes. It's not all the time, though. And that's a lot of what we heard years ago. It's sometimes food. And it's true. It's not what you do or think sometimes. It's what you think all the time that shapes your life. It's not what you eat sometimes. It's what you eat every day.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about the opposite of empowerment, which would be losing control, which can cause anxiety and fear in people. Now, you say that in traditional Chinese medicine, the kidneys store anxiety and fear. I've got a book open in front of me right now written by an osteopath. And here's what he has to say about kidney people. So this is people who have stress in their kidneys. And this is what kind of symptoms they'll express with. A lowered potential to achieve. Fear, both existential and reactive. Fear of being abandoned. A great feeling of insecurity. And a need to prove oneself. What are your thoughts on how this anxiety can affect our body? And how can it affect the way that we interact with people and our world?
I think it's pretty much everything. I think the kidney is, you know, that was a great explanation. It's about not feeling safe in the world. The world is not a safe place to be. You feel isolated, you feel alone. A lot of studies that are being done now about children and anxiety, it's stemming from not having a safe environment, not feeling unconditionally loved, not feeling that that you can push your boundaries a little bit and still be loved or have role models there that are there to protect you as a child. So anxiety, trauma, childhood trauma, it's a really hard one to shake. It's really difficult to change your subconscious brain, which is your first 7 years of programming, really, they say. I think anxiety is the worst thing that's going on now on our planet, even with genetically modified foods and adding toxic folic acid to our wheat and in all the other horrible things, the fructose, high fructose syrup, all the horrible things we're eating, anxiety, because I see people who eat those things and they're fine because they're not stressed. They're surfing, you know, they're not working too hard, nothing really bothers them. You know, long term, maybe that'll catch up on them, but it depends on your disposition. I know with myself, anxiety, which is adrenaline, right? It's fight or flight response when you're pumping out adrenaline and cortisol, is the absolute worst thing that I do for myself. Absolutely. Which is why I meditate now twice a day for 20 minutes because, excuse me, it's the only thing that can, you know, these lists we have in our head, even when I'm still, when I'm trying to be still, the lists, and doing 10 things at once. And, you know, you've heard about it a lot. There's lots of podcasts. There's lots of talks around the world. There's lots of everything on this now, isn't there? People know that we're busy and we're too busy and we're doing too much and we don't have time out, and hunters and gatherers used to work 12 hours a week and the rest of the time they'd sit around chewing the fat with each other, and they had boredom. They were bored, which was actually really healthy. We're not bored now. People just are going, I've got no time, and the kids aren't, you know, outside enough and getting into the trees and the grass, and they're inside. And we know all this, but we're not really doing much about it. We're still super busy and we're still praised for our achievements. And, you know, I've recently taken a few months, not off, but just from flying, just for winter, and people don't know what to say to me. They think that you're all right. I mean, why? Because I need a break. I haven't ever had one, and I just keep going and going and going, and I don't feel great, and I feel like I'm putting on weight because my adrenal glands are stuffed, and it's not what I'm eating, and I had a personal trainer every morning for an hour, and I put on weight. And after that, I was going, okay, I need to stop doing, which is a yang way of being, and I need to start being, which is yin and more feminine and nurturing and receiving energy and things like qigong and tai chi and getting energy from the universe and putting it in rather than expending it is the way forward. You can. It doesn't mean you have to do less. It doesn't mean I have to stop trying to save the world. It just means you need to have a break sometimes and then get back into it and do it from a different way. I was just, and a lot of people were, on an absolute mission and nothing stopped. I had petrol tank, the accelerators were on full and there was no petrol in the tanks. And it's a really good way to get burnout. You know, in the old days we used to call it nervous breakdown. You know, you'd hear that. I remember when I was a kid, there was a guy wrote out a nervous breakdown. It was like, ooh, ooh. People are having these every second now, but it's, we call it chronic fatigue, metabolic syndrome, cancer. And I wrote a blog on this last year too, that is adrenal exhaustion the precursor to all of our modern diseases? And I think it's got a lot to do with it actually, because the hormones come into it, we don't digest, the back gets sore, you can't sleep, and then all your relationships are affected, and then what's the point? And then we get depressed. So, you know, moving to the country was the best thing I ever did.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, in traditional Chinese medicine, they would say that the kidneys would be a water organ. And if we talk about the yin and yang, doing stuff, going and working, using your brain, going to work, working out in the gym, all that kind of stuff would be like fire. So you're burning, you're creating things, you know, you've got energy. And if we put this anxiety and this fear stress on the kidneys and we have all this fire going on that the kidneys, which are a water organ, need to try and control, then that can be too much for them and that can lead to inflammation, which is just basically things are burning out. Do you see a link between all this inflammation that's going on, which I see as being one of the first steps to, you know, creating symptoms for yourself, and this anxiety and fear?
I think there's a I feel there's a direct correlation. It is about burning the candles at two ends, at both ends. And in Chinese medicine, there's a word called jing, which is J-I-N-G, which is your essence, really, your sexual essence. And that's what you get at birth, at conception, when you're conceived, and the sperm, the egg that makes you comes together. And they say that when that runs out is when we die. And the way that that runs out is sex and drugs and rock and roll, basically. So if you're just doing too much, you know when you've had a big night or you've had a huge week working and you haven't had much sleep, you look at yourself and go, oh, my God, I look 10 years older. And you do, because you've aged. And that changes really quickly, though, if you stop doing that, which is, thank God, a blessing. But absolutely, if we burn our kidney energy, our jing out, that's no good. And also the kidney is the mother of the liver. So if the mother's exhausted, the child's going to suffer. And if the child is exhausted or, you know, not well, the mother's going to suffer. So there's a lot of liver problems. Well, there's a lot of liver problems initially, and then it goes back to the kidney and then the kidney to the liver. So which is it? Is interesting to find out in people, is it the chicken or the egg? Is it the liver because they're stressed? The liver holds more stress than any other organ besides the heart, but there's an amazing, really interesting connection between the heart and the liver in Chinese medicine. The liver is a really, really important organ. If you get that working well and getting a lot of the toxins out, then the kidney is in much better shape. A lot of anxiety, I treat the liver, and because it is a kidney thing directly, but if you treat the liver, the kidney just gets so much better. Anxiety is decreased.
This is probably going to sound absolutely crazy to people who are listening but who haven't heard of Chinese medicine before, but it makes perfect sense when you take a step back and think about it.
It never feels crazy. When I tell people, they go, oh, yeah, most people love this. They love it.
Well, I enjoy listening to it. Now, what would you say is the key to lasting success in the pursuit of any health goal?
Own it. Own your life. Own it, own it, own it. And don't try and know that if you want a quick fix, go to your GP and get some drugs, because that's going to band-aid it probably short term. And then be prepared to get on the merry-go-round and the long-term train of pharmaceutical drugs, because one, you'll need one to patch up the symptoms of the other. I'm not saying it's always bad, but it's, you know, you don't need them for lots of things now. So I think knowing that there's a lifetime of looking after your body and loving your body and treating it as a temple, it's not just the temple, you have to treat it as one, really, you know, respecting your body. You can party and play up every now and again, but, you know, 30% of the time you've got a bit of leeway, but try and be good the rest of the time, but own it and know it's long term and do the things that are really sensible to you. Go to have good sleep, have beautiful water, have whole foods, eat as many organic foods as you can, but you own it. There's, I don't know if you know Anita Morjani. She's been on the lecture circuit the last few years. She wrote a book called Dying to Be Me. It's a wonderful little book. You could read it in a day. She was so scared of getting cancer that she ate an organic vegan diet. She got cancer and she passed over and had a near-death experience. And she was in a coma at like 40 kilos, I think, with lymphoma. And her relations came from everywhere. She was an Indian woman. She was buzzing around in the afterworld on the plane, listening to her brother talk on the plane to someone and in the hospital. So she was aware where she was and had a choice whether to come back or not to teach people about the message of health. It's like, it's wonderful, because she said, I was so concerned. My intention was cancer. My intention was cancer. The fear was her drive. So instead of her thinking, oh, I want to eat organic food and I want to eat the best diet for me because it's going to make me feel great and my brain work well and my body feel really good, I'm eating this because I'm petrified of getting cancer. So she came from a place of fear. She didn't come from a place of empowerment, which is what she talks about now. You need to be empowered in your life. You need to own it in order to feel well. And I think, you know, some people are eating really healthy food and they're very uptight about it and they're really sick. And we see that a lot. Instead of people going, yeah, I'm just going to have a pasta every now and again and some wine, and they feel strong and they feel good about their lives and they're not as sick. And I know that my gut has gotten worse and worse over the years when I'm stressed. When I'm happy, I can drink beer and eat pizza and I lose weight and I feel great. Sometimes. I mean, not all the time, but when I'm like, I can't eat that, I get sick. So it's about empowering your life by owning it and you being the master of the ship and the captain of your soul. I really believe that.
Exactly. I always tell people a healthy body should be able to withstand a certain amount of stress, or otherwise what's the point of turning yourself into a glass statue and you can never do anything or eat anything. You'd never enjoy your life. Now, what would be some red flags or some thought processes that you think people might be having that would signify that they're disempowered or they're operating from this anxiety and fear mindset that they can catch themselves on around food?
I can't eat anything. That's a big one. And it's true. I've been there when you can't eat anything. I was so stressed last year at one point, I couldn't swallow water without having pain in my esophagus and my digestive tract, because my whole gut, when you're in stress, your gut tightens, everything constricts. Because you're not supposed to be hungry when you're stressed. You're supposed to be getting away from that woolly mammoth. So nothing's going to go down. So when people feel disempowered by I can't eat anything, and they don't, and I have lots of patients and clients like this, they don't go out for dinner, they don't go to their friends' houses, they don't see their family because they want to control exactly what they're eating. This is an eating disorder. And this is what used to be only, it was saved for bulimics and anorexic, but this is really quite worrying that people aren't having a full life with their community and having spiritual nourishment from their kin because they're afraid of what they can and can't eat. And I understand the pain that is involved with gut problems. I absolutely do. I've had it my whole life on and off, but it's not about isolating yourself and feeling disempowered because you can't eat wheat, you can't eat dairy, you can't eat gluten, you can't eat MSG, you can't eat sulfur, you can't eat blah, blah, blah. And you don't want to eat anything that's not sustainable or locally caught. It's difficult to be like that all the time and be relaxed. But if you can do the best you can and be like that mostly, when I'm at home, I have full control over my diet and I eat what I want. I buy locally, I grow most of our stuff. We catch fish if we eat it. It's wonderful. But if I go out, I mean, I live in the Byron hinterlands. Let's face it, most people eat like I do. But if I'm going somewhere else, you know, my partner's family, they're Aussies. They have meat and white bread. That's pretty much it. So I take something and I've been educating them along the way as well. But, you know, sometimes I have a little bit of white bread with some cheese that's not organic because it makes everybody a little bit more comfortable and my body should be able to handle that.
Do you think there can be a flip side to that where it's not necessarily I can't eat anything? Like, I'm remembering a couple of weeks ago, I went around to a friend's house to watch a rugby game or something like that, and everyone was drinking beer, and I think there was pizza or something like that, and I just didn't eat any. And everyone's like, what's wrong? Why didn't you eat? And I said, I just didn't want to eat it. I just ate before I came. And I wasn't freaking out about it. I just thought, nah, just eat before I go, just so I don't have to eat that kind of stuff. Is that bad or is that possible?
Well, you're sensible. And there's an ad like that on TV at the moment, isn't there, with the Aussie blokes and with the pie? And the guys are I'd much rather have the pie. I think blokes might have that a bit more, that you'd get picked on probably. Not in Sydney, in the inner city though. But I think blokes get that more. And absolutely. And I write lots of articles about this before Christmas especially. Editors get me to write how to get around all the party food and the season of the silly season. Eat before you go out. And a lot of people go straight from work to a cocktail party or a function. Have a smoothie in the afternoon at 5 o'clock or 5:30 before you leave work so you're full because you're starving then normally. So you're just going to eat vol-au-vents or whatever and cheese and pastry and you don't want to. So absolutely eat first, for sure. And if you're going to any sort of party, if there's cheesels there and chips there and you're hungry, you're going to eat them. It's like people who live with, you know, their husbands eat differently to them or their kids eat differently or their wives. And they say, oh, I've just, you know, come home and I polish off, you know, half a packet of Arnott's biscuits. I'm like, why are they even in the house? Because somebody else has bought them. And if they're there, you're going to eat them often, even though you don't want them to be there. I mean, if you live on your own or with a partner who eats like you or you have full control of it, great. But I think what you did is sensible and I think a lot of us who are health conscious do that sort of thing. But if you can't and you feel, you know, there's always going to be peer group pressure, isn't there? There always is. And also, if it was a thin pizza that they made themselves with spelt pastry, get into it.
My friends don't do that.
No. So, yeah, eat before you go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Or now, take a pizza. Take one.
Yeah. Mm. Now, before the show, you sent me a speech of yours, which you're delivering soon. And in it, you mentioned the 100th monkey story. Now, I'm hoping that you haven't heard a different version of this story to me because I absolutely loved it. Do you want to share that story with the listeners and what it has to do with health?
Yeah, sure. You know, I heard this at a seminar years ago by a Chinese medicine practitioner, and I actually just have the quote here. So, the definition actually. Where do I put it? Where is it? Have you got? Oh, there it is. Okay. The 100th monkey. It's when we decide.
I've got the quote in front of me. You said, the 100th monkey effect is a studied phenomenon in which a new behavior or idea is claimed to spread rapidly by unexplained means from one group to all related groups once a critical number of members of one group exhibit the new behavior or acknowledge the new idea.
Yeah, you know, when I used to study I still do study metaphysics and fractals and I'm into, you know, the world of maths. We call it the, what was it called? Morphic resonance. I think he was the guy that coined it. So they did some studies on rats in Switzerland, I think it was, and they changed the behavior of the rats by taking their food away or something like that. So these rats started a new behavior. And then I think it was within a few months or a year around the world that all the rats started having a different behavior. It's like when something's invented, like the phone, the telephone, when Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, many more people invented it afterwards. So it's like, you know, when something comes out and you go, why hasn't anyone done that before? It's because the energy or the info, the thought is out there and it lifts consciousness and then we all get it, which is why it's really important for each one of us to be empowered and the best we can be because we have then an effect on everybody around us.
Now, the 100th monkey story, the way that I heard it was that there was, you know, it's probably made up, but who cares? There was a guy who was studying monkeys and he noticed a monkey did a thing that was weird. Let's say he learned how to fish or something like that. And this monkey was doing it and one of his monkey friends noticed him fishing. And he figured out how to do it himself just by watching his monkey friend. And then two monkeys saw this second monkey doing it. And then soon there were monkeys all through the jungle watching each other fish. Mm. in this one particular area. And as soon as there were a certain amount of monkeys who had this collective consciousness of, you know, monkeys know how to fish, people all around the world, monkey doctors everywhere, started blogging and saying, oh my God, I noticed monkeys fishing in Sydney or Byron Bay or wherever, or
it's
Peru.
It's the same thing. It's a real, I think we know so little about what is actually going on in the ethers. But yeah, I think when an idea catches on, like the internet, you know, we talk, whether or not this is a physical phenomena or a metaphysical phenomena, this is probably what we're talking about here, but it's real and we know it. Once it catches on, this is why it's so important that positivity and empowerment catches on and light rather than darkness. And it is when you're around people who are negative and whinging and moaning and being judgmental, it's not a nice place to be, is it? You'd rather be around people who are positive. And I mean, as much as, you know, I'm so very, very happy I'm Australian, Americans have a really good can-do attitude and they're very into, they don't have the tall poppy syndrome like we have in Australia. We like to kind of, you know, cut each other down a little bit. But to empower each other is a really lovely thing to do, obviously, and that's why I only surround myself when I can in my private life with positive people who are trying to make a difference on the planet, creating change, being thought leaders in what they do and feeling really inspired by their life, and I feel inspired and being around them. And this is, I think this is what we're talking about with the 100th monkey effect. It takes 100 monkeys for something to catch on.
It's like a weird way of describing the 4-minute mile. Now, that can work both ways, because you can be with a group of friends thinking, God, how are we ever going to quit drinking or smoking or eating McDonald's every Friday night or having our Saturday night pizza or whatever. Or it can be done in the other ways, in you're one of those people who thinks the 4-minute mile, was it 4 minutes or 3 minutes? I don't know. The 4-minute mile can be done, or that.
I don't know what you're talking about with that.
Have you not heard of the 4-minute mile? That guy, Roger.
Yeah. But I don't know how it's relative.
Well, because no one thought the 4-minute mile could be done, but there was. Yeah.
Right.
You got me. Now we're confusing each other today. This is not going well. How can someone be part of that in a good way rather than a bad way? So, how can we be those monkeys who move forward rather than be one of those people who thinks, oh, that 4-minute mile is never going to get broken and therefore never break it?
I don't know that people who are thought leaders or creating change have the easiest life, I'm sorry to say. I don't know that you can be everybody's best friend when you're offering something different that's a little bit hard. And it's not for everyone. Some people, you know, want to be the, you know, catalyst of change, and then slowly. But I see a lot of people who are incredible in what they're doing in their lives and really caring and empathic and helping in third worlds. They're not very well. They've got heart problems and gut problems because they care so much. And I don't know that you do something like this to make friends. If you do want to, like, stay with your mates and have pizza and beer, do it. I mean, it's not going to really kill you if you do it once a week and then you empower your life and do what you can the rest of the time, because it's not really our jobs to change people's minds. I think we lead by example, by our behavior. And if people go, wow, look at her life. I think that's why I was popular in the beginning, because I'm not a goody two-shoes. I do drink and I do, you know, have a pretty balanced life, and I'm not like, oh, I'm not having that. People are like, oh, God, I don't have to be a goody two-shoes Puritan to be healthy. I actually think it's the other way. I think have balance and, you know, own your life. So I don't know that shoving something down anyone's throat, or you shouldn't be eating that, is ever any good. Really, it's just lead by example and let other people make their own minds up, children especially, and husbands. And because a lot of men come to me because their wives make them, and they sit there and they put their arms crossed and they're like, I'm like, what are you doing? What do you want me to do? I don't know, my wife sent me. And then by the end they feel empowered because it's, what do you want to get out of this? And, okay, let's make some deals. You can keep the beer. You can do that, but you have to add that and you can do that, and we make some deals so they own it. But I don't think – you know, sometimes you do lose friends when your energy changes, when your vibration changes, when you do get when you're more finely tuned, the wrong people drop away. It's like getting sacked is the best thing that could ever happen to you sometimes, because it's not where you should be. So that's where the fear comes in again, and it is lonely sometimes. And it is, but you know what? There's more and more people that talk like this. When I was a kid, people tell me now from primary school, you were always like this. You're always searching. You're always asking answers. You were always wondering what was on the other side. Was I? I didn't even really – I guess I knew that. But I felt really alone in that. I always felt quite alone that I had a few mentors and my mother I could talk to, thank God. But now it's everyone. Now it's mainstream, really. It's incredible. It's beautiful. So it's not so hard. It's not so isolating now.
Mm, well, you don't have to be that one monkey fishing by himself anymore, eh?
Yeah, that's it. There's 100. There's more. Everyone's moving to Byron anyway, so there's thousands of monkeys.
That's the one. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure having you on. I can't thank you enough for sharing your wisdom with us.
Now, thanks for inviting me, Dad. It's been a joy.
This is really something that's hugely important, I think, is empowerment rather than feeling feeling a sense of obligation to achieve a goal. I think that's a really big key. So your knowledge has been absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been all mine. Thanks, David. Bye, everyone.
Raw Health Radio.